You're listening to The Human Upgrade with Dave Asprey. Formerly Bulletproof Radio.
A state of high performance.
You're listening to The Human Upgrade with Dave Asprey. And if you're watching the video or hearing unusual licking sounds here, that's because I have a cookie on my lap. This is a gluten-free cookie named Cookie. A wonderful, kind dog who just happens to hang out most of the time with today's guest, who is none other than Luke Story. Luke and I have known each other for a long time. He was a consulting, coaching client of mine many years ago and has done 40 years of Zen and is a big voice in the biohacking movement and has really grown as a person since we started and changed from being the school of style into talking about a broad range of metaphysical and other biohacking things. And I wanted to chat with you today on the show, mostly because we're in Austin, and so it's easy to do guests together. And we just did a podcast on your show. And so, guys, you should check out Luke Story's show and listen to my interview there, because we went into some really cool stuff I haven't talked about anywhere else, because he asked good questions. And so I want to talk about psychedelics and addiction and recovery, because Luke is has been very public about his history with addiction. And the reason you might say, oh, I don't care about this, is like, I don't have addiction. You actually may. A lot of people have addictions that are just more socially acceptable, like a work addiction, sex addiction, gambling, social media. In fact, it's exceptionally common. But more importantly, what we're going to talk about in this episode is why and how your body does that, and how it could possibly be. So I'm going to go deep on this with you. You're going to learn something about how you're wired in a way that's invisible to you. Plus, talking about psychedelics is always fun. I mean, it could be even trippy. Who would ever get that?
It's certainly that, my friend.
Luke, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man. It's good to be back. It's been a while since we dropped in on your show.
Yeah, that's been like several hundred episodes. I was just looking at my notes.
It was quite a few ago.
Yeah, you were episode 562 on spirituality hacking and negativity fasting.
Yeah.
We're at about 1,000 and change. So yeah, that's probably 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So it was long overdue.
And a lot has changed, you know, especially in the realm of finding different ways to heal trauma and work on one's emotional state, you know, specifically in the realm of psychedelics, as you alluded to in the intro, you know. So yeah, I've lived a lot of lives since we did that last podcast.
Will you indulge me for a second and imagine who you would be if you actually had more energy, if your brain fired faster and you could measure it, and you had a calmer nervous system that worked better? That's what this show, that's what my work is all about. You can be that person with a few fixes that really work. In my brand new book, Smarter, Not Harder, I will teach you about the little things that make the biggest difference in your life so you can be that person. There's a new anti-nutrient that you haven't heard about yet that is weakening everything you do, from your workouts to your meditations. You can remove it from your diet and you'll notice a shift quickly. Learn how to get the right amount of exercise for you in the very least amount of time, and it's way less than you think. Smarter, Not Harder is about simplicity and efficiency so you have more time to work on the things that matter to you. You can use the time to work on yourself or to help other people, but it's time that's yours that you're not using effectively right now. If you want to get your energy back like I did, you want to manage the stress so you can handle anything, maybe even drop the weight, check out Smarter, Not Harder wherever you buy books. This is stuff you haven't seen anywhere else. Smarter, Not Harder. Thank you for your support.
Yeah, I've lived a lot of lives since we did that last podcast.
I've been watching you online and all. You've definitely, what's the word for it? You've become more grounded and just well-rounded, and just in your approach to things. So I think you're doing really good work, and it's awesome.
Thank you, sir.
And your show has grown, and I can definitely see it. So, and you're one of the voices in biohacking, and it is a global movement, and we need people who are spiritually paying attention, in addition to, you know, looking at the latest in ketones. Because yeah. I mean, frankly, if you get your ketones right, you'll have more energy. But what are you going to do with it? Well, eventually you're going to realize you got to like hack the invisible parts of your body. And I feel like anyone who's successfully dealt with addiction and recovered from it ends up having some aspect of spirituality come in. And I've become more and more convinced that a lot of what feels like spiritual stuff and thus is spiritual stuff is our interface with our body and our body's interface with reality. It's just the stuff that we don't normally see. It's hidden because it's too big to pay attention to all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think right now it's, you know, it's interesting as someone who was a very committed, diehard addict who suffered for a long time. Well, I'll be honest. I had fun for a little bit of it.
I mean, people drink alcohol for a reason, right?
There was a few months maybe where I kind of had it in balance. But, you know, the thing is when you sober up, which for me was 25 years ago when I was 26 years old, you kind of go into this bubble because you surround yourself with, hopefully at least, I think people are more successful when they do so. You surround yourself with other people in recovery and other people that are supportive and getting healthier and happier and doing all the things, right? And so you sort of lose touch with the fact that there are still untold numbers of people who are still stuck in that trap. And I sort of forget, but in the past 3 years, it's come to my awareness that this has become an even bigger problem than ever. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that one of the main underlying issues in addiction is just loneliness, right? A disconnection from other people. And so many people have been separated from their loved ones. And specifically within the model of recovery, so far the best we've done are 12-step groups. And you know, a lot of the success there has to do with teaching people fundamental spiritual principles by which to live so that you feel better. And when you feel better, because you have a connection to something greater than yourself, as you alluded to, you don't feel the need to use drugs. But a lot of it is just the unconditional love, like that field of energy that's present in a group of people that all share one purpose, and that purpose is to get sober, right? And you're supporting one another. So you had all of these people around the world that were losing touch with their community, and people in recovery that were losing touch with their very insulated community of people like them, right? And relying on Zoom meetings and things like that. And I know for myself in the beginning, I mean, it took a lot for me to walk into a church basement. You know, I had to really want to get well, and to do that sometimes two or three times a day just to keep my feet on the ground. So to get me to log on to a Zoom meeting or go back to the bar or call the dealer, I can imagine a lot of people fell off, and I know they did, you know. And then you have the prevalence of fear in the air, especially in the beginning when it was kind of unclear and we didn't know what was going on and there were so many conflicting ideas about what was happening. So you have people who are very often living with a lot of unresolved trauma, who are now being traumatized by the experience and the media and all of those things. So you have traumatized people being more traumatized who now don't have the ability to connect with supportive communities. So, you know, now I think is a really important time. And it's one of the reasons that I've been more outspoken about this, is just to remind myself, just because I made it out of the, you know, abyss of addiction doesn't mean that everyone did. You know, there's still people out there on the streets that are really suffering, and also people running companies and heads of families and everything else. I mean, all walks of life, as you said, are prone to addiction to something. And I would argue that even if we don't have an addiction to a substance or a behavior, many of us are addicted to false thoughts that we continually think that we can't stop. Right? It's like
do you mean like a plant-based diet is good for me despite the fact my teeth are falling out of my head, the plant-based diet is good for me?
That could be one false thought, yeah. But right, it's the rumination. It's the limbic system just continually feeding oneself thoughts and feelings that are disempowering, you know? And sometimes we can't stop even doing that, right? It's like, try to not think a thought right now. Everyone stop thinking. Good luck, right? So we're all habituated to something.
So you think of that as an addiction. That's actually kind of profound, Luke. I had never thought of that. I teach people a lot now, especially within the 40 years of Zen and some of the stuff in Smarter Not Harder, on my newest book that just came out. I teach them how to turn off notifications in the brain. But I've never thought of that as an addiction. Because if your brain constantly gives you an alert, well, alerts kind of feel good because like they get a little dopamine, a little bit of attention, a little bit of cortisol. So if you have a belief system like I am a victim because I'm a member of X, or I'm a victim because something happened to me, or I am amazing for no reason, therefore I deserve. These are all facets of narcissism. they are.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the I deserve even though I didn't do something. Right. And but the idea that those little alerts, so you get a little squirt of anger every time someone else has something you don't have, or every time the world didn't match your inner story, you get angry. Then maybe that's an addiction.
Yeah. I mean, wow. It's like an addiction to one's own biochemistry, right? To cortisol, to adrenaline.
Did you just explain the whole woke movement?
Possibly, inadvertently, yeah. But this is from my own subjective experience.
It's totally true.
I mean, when I got sober, which was in and of itself, I mean, it's not overstating to say that it was a miracle. I mean, there was no statistical probability of a guy like me being free of addiction. I mean,
you broke all the rules.
It's exceedingly rare.
And by the way, just for listeners, crack and heroin were part of your story, not just alcohol.
Oh, yeah, for sure, yeah. Especially heroin. For that one, I'm actually really grateful because I think if I had just been an alcoholic and I also just smoked weed like it was air, you know, I mean, just literally 24/7 for years. But with heroin, it just gets so dark, you know, and what happens when you go through withdrawal from opiates is a very unique experience, and it is nothing short of torture, right?
Wow.
So thankfully for me, things like crack and heroin sped up the process so that by the time I was 26, which is when many people start kind of experimenting and going into it, I was already looking for the exit door, you know? But yeah, it was like that. But to the earlier point of addiction to negativity and just, like you said, mm-hmm. those hateful thoughts or fearful thoughts, it took me about one day to realize when I walked out of rehab that drugs and alcohol weren't really what my problem was.
Oh, and wow. What was your problem?
My problem, well, now I perceive that it was unresolved trauma, right?
Yes.
And also the compounding trauma of being an addict, because you put yourself in situations continually in which you are victimized or in which you are a perpetrator of harm on others. So the whole cycle of behavior.
It re-traumatizes you.
Yeah,
right?
The drama and destruction and the compounding of the shame of knowing that you're doing something that's antithetical to your well-being and the well-being of those about you for whom you have love, family, friends, etc. So this compounding shame, so when you take the drugs and alcohol away, or at least in my case, it's like having a raging migraine and you just removed the aspirin. You know, it's like you just ripped the Band-Aid off, and that's where the real work begins, which was a shock to me, much to my chagrin, because everyone externally in my life had always said, Luke, you know, you're an addict, you're an alcoholic, all your problems are because of that. If you just got sober, you'd be a great guy. So I eventually comply with that just out of my own suffering and being at a real dead end. You know, I like to call it a subterranean bottom. It's like the bottom that's underneath the bottom. I mean, emotionally. So, and that's when the real work began. And, you know, things before there was a word biohacking, I mean, I started doing hyperbaric chambers and infrared
anything
saunas.
Work.
We
needed a word for what we do.
Yeah, but you were just called a health nut then,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But making kombucha, getting into herbalism. So, you know, I realized, wow, I'm so physically toxic and sick, I can't think. My emotions are so erratic, and I was so obsessed with thoughts that were harmful to myself. And that's where I have that idea of like being addicted to one's thinking, where I might have a grievance or a resentment towards someone, right? I mean, resentments are classic for people in recovery. Everyone knows that that's the road to relapse. So say somebody cut me off in traffic. A healthy, normal person that had a brain that functions properly would be afraid for a moment, feel threatened, and then self-regulate and move on with their day. I haven't thought about this in a long time. I would fantasize about tracking that person down, hurting them, you know what I mean? I would be thinking about that interaction all day.
It's crazy. I was the same way. I had toxic mold-induced brain damage. And I was, I mean, my middle finger was very strong.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know,
well exercised.
The amount of rage that would bring up for me at that time, it was pathological, absolutely pathological. Yeah. And I'm not proud of it at all. And in fact, I was ashamed of it when I would, like, why would I do that? Well, I did it because my brain wasn't working. I had a hardware problem. And I had a forgiveness problem, too. Resentment comes from that. And it's interesting. Why do you think some people hold resentment but don't become addicts? Or do you think they're just addicted to that feeling of resentment?
You know, it's interesting. I've, of course, pondered this. Why you have, I mean, even siblings. Like, I have two siblings, right? Two half-brothers. And they had a different set of childhood circumstances and their own set of what I would consider to be trauma. I'll let them label it for themselves. But, you know, went through a divorce and parents with their own issues, as many of us have. One of them is like me. He's now sober too, my brother Cody, thankfully, 12 years or so. But they both had very, very close in age, very similar circumstances. One sort of withdrew and became a little bit insulated in his personality. That's my brother Andy. He's still somewhat that way, just kind of an introverted person and he's not very expressive. And he had his own way of coping with his childhood. You can't get that guy to drink half a beer. He just doesn't like it. Whatever bothers him is not medicated by drugs and alcohol. My other brother, case study, basically the same experience externally. The minute he tried drugs as a young teenager, like me, just it was the answer. It just solved all the problems, you know? So I think it has something to do, and this is just a guess, I think it has something to do with just our biological makeup, that some of us seem to find ease and solution with certain substances for our trauma or unresolved emotional pain or just disconnection from spirit or people or whatever that is that causes us to suffer emotionally and mentally. And you can have the same exact person with the same circumstances and they have another coping mechanism. And for them, for some unknown reason, drugs and alcohol don't provide a remedy and they just find a way to cope.
It's interesting that you chose two of the most addictive substances. I mean, heroin and cocaine, right? And cocaine removes your ability to feel happiness without it, so you feel pain without it.
Like, oh, that's God.
What it does.
There's nothing worse.
And even someone without trauma who does cocaine for a while is going to fall into that because it's neurochemical. But if you're predisposed to having trauma, and there are people who are genetically predisposed to having higher vagal tone, for instance, or just like a nervous system that just naturally goes more towards fight or flight, right? And then you also had heroin, which, you know, opiate receptors, we all have those. And, you know, you get anyone addicted to heroin, even if they don't get predisposed. So you just give it to them every day for a few weeks.
Yeah, like, you see this a lot with people that go on pharmaceutical opiates and synthetic opiates and whatnot, right?
Yeah.
Where they're not a drug addict type person, and they get physically dependent on it. It's a really interesting...
It's an interesting business model, isn't it? Like, you force people to inject stuff for a while until they just can't live without it. You might be onto something there. Someday you're going to make something of yourself.
Yeah. My entrepreneurial mind is taking note. But yeah, man, it all boils down, Dave, to me and my experience. I mean, in the, you know, couple decades plus that I've been somehow able to not be addicted to anything. Well, maybe other than nicotine. I think if I'm really honest, I have a nicotine habit with these Lucy snoozes.
I don't think it's that bad.
Well, I'm going to say classically, I would say I'm addicted to it, but it doesn't have any deleterious effects on my life. Where, like, my model of addiction is that you're doing something that is harmful to you and the people with whom you share your life, and the consequences outweigh the benefits, and you still can't stop doing it.
You just said the consequences, benefits, and all that. Because one of the things people say, I don't want to drink coffee because I'd be addicted. I'm like, okay, let me just put this scenario out there. There's something you do every day that makes you feel good. And when you stop doing it, even for a day or two, you don't feel good. Are you addicted? And they say, yes. I say, great, I'm talking about exercise. Yeah. Like, that's not an addiction. I'm like, triggered much? Right. So what's going on here is risk and benefits, right? Is there a downside to drinking coffee? Yes. It's very small compared to the upside, but I'm sure that you can find some. And then with nicotine, high doses of nicotine, hair loss, erectile dysfunction, you might not want to overdo it, right? But low doses of nicotine, really good for you. I find, after having used it consistently for 10 years, never having smoked, okay, maybe I smoked a cigar at a wedding or something, but I've never been a cigarette smoker. I've never smoked a cigarette in my life. I'm like, you know what? I've gone through phases. The first 5 years, 1 milligram a day, just one a day. And I'm like, yeah, I love it. I'm going to do more.
What what form of nicotine comes in 1 milligram? Because I do the gum, and they're like 4 or 6 milligrams. And I find that I get a lot of cognitive benefit, and I experience just feeling more grounded when I use nicotine.
Yeah,
and
it's
then
very
thinking about the shamanic perspective, which my wife pointed out to me. She said, well, it's no accident that human civilizations, especially in the shamanic realms, have used nicotine and continue to do so.
We have to talk about that on this episode.
For their grounding benefit.
This year's biohacking conference has more chambers than Harry Potter. Okay, not really, but it's a dad joke, and it is in Orlando this year. Seriously, some of the incredible results I've had with my biohacking come from large pieces of equipment. Call them biohacking chambers that help you recover, detox, and heal. Go to the biohacking conference so you can demo all of these and feel what they're like. Things like hyperbaric oxygen with OxyHealth, our title sponsor, infrared light, cold chambers, heat chambers, ozone chambers, even salt chambers. Join me at my 9th annual biohacking conference in Orlando, June 22nd to 24th. I've been working with a company called Omnibiotic, who made a targeted probiotic with unique powder delivery mechanisms that make sure you get a high probiotic survival rate in your intestines, because who wants to take a probiotic that never even starts growing in the body? I've noticed a real difference after taking Omnibiotic for a few months now. My digestion is rock solid, and these strains are designed specifically for detoxification and even for brain function and stress management, and you can feel it. Go to omnibioticlife.com/Dave. Use code Dave20 for 20% off. That's omnibioticlife.com/Dave. Use code Dave20. And you can get specific strains that do specific things that change how you feel.
Especially in the shamanic realms, have used nicotine and continue to do so.
We have to talk about that on this episode.
For the grounding benefit, right? I mean, the tobacco plant is a sacred plant for good reason. So, and that could also sound like a justification. You could say, well, the opium poppy is also sacred, but there is some utility value in nicotine. So I'm not hard on myself about it, but I'm also just honest. If you said like, hey, Luke, what if we throw away all your nicotine gum tonight? I'd probably be fishing it out of the trash can.
Yeah. I get it. I'm kind of the same way. 1 milligram nicotine, you can buy Nicorette mini lozenges. They have the least amount of bad sweetener of anything available in the U.S.
The aspartame issue?
Those don't have aspartame. The mini ones don't, but the full size do. And you break them in half and you get 1 milligram.
Oh, there you go. Good to know.
But what I use now is Nicorette spray that you can buy in Europe or Canada. And you can also buy it in the U.S., but it's not approved here. So you have to buy it on eBay or somewhere. That's a 1 milligram dose per spray.
Oh, cool.
But it's really kind of convenient. You have something in your pocket. People see me do it on the show all the time, right? And it is a great cognitive enhancer. Oh my God, it's almost as good as modafinil and coffee. And I believe almost every great work of writing, of authorship, has been done on coffee and nicotine.
I saw a tweet the other day that said, the United States was built on nicotine and caffeine.
It was. Wars have been won on it. In fact, literally the supply chain for coffee is a deciding factor from the Civil War forward. It's crazy. Yeah. So these are fundamental drugs. But when it comes to nicotine, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to take the gloves off. I just like my life on a little bit of nicotine. And it's an anti-aging drug and anti-Alzheimer's at low doses. And smoking's bad for you. So guys, don't smoke, don't chew. It's bad for you.
Yeah. If I was smoking cigarettes, I mean, it'd be a different conversation.
Yeah, we'd be cooked.
I smoked for a long, long time. And I think that's why I have wrestled a bit with the guilt of using nicotine in different forms that are much more safe and that from which I derive benefit, because when I quit smoking, it was like quitting drinking and all the other drugs. It was just a hard stop. I'm done, never again kind of thing. But then I heard people like you talking about the cognitive benefits of nicotine. I was like, well, I mean, I'm not going to start smoking, but what's a little gum, you know?
As long as it's a little. And what I found is that when I just said, okay, I'm not going to self-regulate, I'm just going to take it whenever I want to. I'm like, I got to the point, I was probably doing like 40 milligrams a day, like 40 sprays a day. And I like it until you get to the point where they don't work very well and you get a little bit nauseous from it. Like, blah. Still, that's 2 cigarettes worth of nicotine. There's 20 milligrams per cigarette. Maybe you don't absorb all of it, but anyway, it's still not that much, but it was too much. So I went cold turkey. The physiological washout for nicotine is 3 days. after that, it's all psychological, but the psychological is strong.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, so I did it and I found I could take like any other kind of essential oil spray. So the habit was done. I found that using a patch works great. Use a patch and just keep cutting the patch in half every 2 days. And pretty soon you're off of it without cravings. Now what I do is I have my little spray thing and I have a time box, like a little box that has like for cell phones or something. And I toss my supply of nicotine in there and I just set it for 24 hours and it doesn't open again. So even if my meat operating system is like, use more nicotine, it's like, oh, I can't. And you're fully in charge when you decide to spray nicotine.
It's I like it.
Later in the day or some other time when I'm focused and just this little voice in the back of my head is like, wouldn't your brain work better on nicotine? And the answer is yes. But it doesn't mean that I choose to do it. It means my body is trying to get me to choose to do it. So I might listen to my body, then I'm like, oh, it's not available. So now I'm on my dose. It's one spray. And if I'm like, today is going to be a heavy day, I'm going to set the box for 12 hours. But if I'm going to do shamanic work or journeying work with substances or neurofeedback or like big energy medicine work, and yes, guys, I do that kind of thing. I have, if you didn't notice this, I had yak butter tea on the side of Mount Kailash. I've interviewed Alberto Vietto. I have a very strong and potent practice that is cross lineage. Anyway, when I do that, bring on the nicotine. I might do 20 sprays in a session and it re-ups whatever substance I may be using for medicinal purposes or for neurofeedback. Although certain forms like 40 years of Zen, nicotine is counterproductive. For other forms, it works better. So I reserve it for the times when it has shamanic uses. And one of the things that convinced me of this was just trying it while I was doing curated, medically supervised vision work with substances like ketamine. There are tobacaneros. These are basically shamans who, instead of using ayahuasca, they're using tobacco at high doses to hallucinate. And a friend of mine who's a very, very powerful shaman, some people may guess who it is, but that's up to him to tell the story in full. I convinced him to try nicotine for the first time. He'd never done it because of purity and did not want to be addicted and all that other kind of stuff. So he takes a spray, flies back on the couch, literally flies back, starts speaking in a language he doesn't know. And literally, according to him, the spirits of the ancestors of North American indigenous people came into the room and they had a 2-hour conversation that I was witness to. It was brought on by the sacred spirit of tobacco as concentrated in a pharmaceutically pure spray of nicotine. What the hell? The world's complex. Maybe we're all crazy, but I think nicotine's awesome. Just, I don't want to overdo it. So I outsource the decision of saying no to myself
like
all the time.
I like that. That would work with nicotine.
Yeah.
If it was heroin, you'd be hitting that box open with a sledgehammer about every 4 hours. It'd be like, plan canceled. Boom.
I respect that. We talked a little bit about addiction and why it's exploded in the last 3 years, just the lack of human connection. And you've talked about how 12-step programs, which provide community, have been a very successful. But you said the most successful. What about Ibogaine? I've seen so many powerful neurological arguments that Ibogaine is very potent for addiction. Do you think it's not as strong as 12-step?
Well, I've not worked with Ibogaine, so I can't speak to it directly. Okay. But it is widely known as specifically for opiate addiction. And then, the iboga in terms of traditional ceremonial use is widely revered for its ability to alleviate addictions. And so I think there's some truth to that because there's enough evidence to support that fact. But I think, my case is a little bit unique, Dave, in that I went with the most trusted model.
Yeah.
Based on the historical reference that we have access to outside of indigenous peoples throughout history that have probably done all kinds of things to alleviate addictions. And there were probably fewer things to be addicted to back then anyway, right?
Yeah.
But when I got sober and what's prevalent, and I think wisely so in the 12-step model, is that complete abstinence is the key to long-term sobriety, right?
Yep.
And it has to do with this phenomenon, and it truly is a phenomenon. It's called the phenomenon of craving. And it's when you have an addicted person that's, say, addicted to alcohol, right, which I was. And if I drank alcohol, I could not control the amount that I drank or the duration that I would drink or the frequency with which I drank. But additionally, if I drank alcohol, I had zero resistance to taking other drugs that I really didn't want to take. And this is this kind of thing that I like to refer to as switching seats on the Titanic, right? It's like you see this a lot when people are trying to get sober. Oh, I'm just going to use cannabis, or I'll just have a few beers, or I'll just do a little blow on the weekend. And inevitably, no matter what seat you're on, the ship is going down. So because of the phenomenon of craving that's very common, and I would say universal really to most addicts, that if you quit one thing, try to substitute with another substance, you'll eventually get addicted to that and likely get back on the first thing that you tried to quit. So based on that idea and my own experience of that year after year, just trying to just, like in my case, I just wanted to use cannabis. I liked it. I could still function, and I was
at least it felt like you could.
Yeah, I mean, I was brain dead. I mean, I functioned at a minimal level, but it didn't destroy my life and put me out on the street at 4 a.m. in dangerous situations and things like that. So I experienced that myself. So then the answer is complete abstinence. You don't do any drugs or any alcohol if you want to be sober and you want that sobriety to last. So that's what I did for 22 years. And I became deeply immersed in all types of different therapy and 12-step groups and going to India to learn to meditate and just anything I could do to better myself and just feel more comfortable in my skin. Because as I said, when I didn't use drugs and alcohol to feel comfortable, it was wildly uncomfortable just to be me in my sober body. And at 22 years, after interviewing a number of people on my podcast and just running with people in similar circles that you and I share, I started to meet people who had been former addicts and went and did Iboga or ayahuasca and were essentially struck sober from the sort of transcendental experience. The potency of that experience would render them sober. And this
very few people I know got cured by using ayah.
I met a few of them.
Interesting.
Enough to pique my interest.
Okay. Yeah.
But still, it took me a few years of just kind of being like, well, that's good for you guys, but I don't trust myself and the kind of addiction that I had that I'm not allowed to play in that sandbox. Like, oh, that's interesting. It's intriguing. And the stories I would hear were fascinating. And not just people getting sober, but people just being absolved of their trauma and their problems and just fundamentally having a change in their character and their whole perception of their reality and their lives dramatically improving as a result of working with psychedelics and plant medicines. But it was still not off the table for me. But I interviewed enough people, I met enough people that, as you often hear, you hear the call, right? That's something people say. And this ayahuasca just kept coming into my awareness to the point where it was like getting ridiculous. Just meeting someone and they could be talking about an infinite number of things and they would start talking about ayahuasca. And this happened for a while and eventually I just started getting this intuitive feeling that it could benefit me. And even though I had been sober for 22 years and had a great life, I was a celebrity fashion stylist in Hollywood and doing all these great things, a musician. And I mean, by outward appearances, I was successful. But there were still areas in my life in which I was stuck, particularly around romantic relationships, just clueless, not successful in making those work in a healthy way, codependency issues and whatnot.
A lot of addicts have codependency. I had to deal with being a codependent when I was younger. It's rough.
It's a real thing. And speaking of like addictions that aren't a substance, being addicted to other people is very real, codependency. So long story short, eventually I interview someone who's got a ayahuasca center in Costa Rica and they invited
He's been on my show too, yeah.
They invited me down there. And I interviewed this channel named Paul Selig, and he taps into these entities or beings, and he asks them questions, and the answers that they reveal are quite profound and seemingly trustworthy and based in truth. You know, it's not really as wacky as it sounds, because when you hear the channel speak through him, you're like, that rings as true. So we were interviewing, and I said, hey, can I just go off the script here a bit? I said, Paul, would it be appropriate to ask your guides if it would be appropriate for me to go to Costa Rica and sit in ayahuasca ceremony? And he listened for a sec and he goes, yeah, I think I can do that. He asked the guides and essentially the message was, it will be safe for you to do as a recovering addict. It's likely that it would benefit you, but you could not go and you'd still be okay, right? And I was like, bing, green light. And went in and had 4 really incredible experiences over the course of a week. And in so doing, I had to totally rearrange my whole model of addiction and and what recovery looks like and what abstinence is. And there was a lot of reconciliation within myself because I had built an identity, and rightly so, of someone who is a sober guy. I am sober. It's like when someone says, I am vegan. Nope, you're a human being who eats plants. I am sober is not an identity, but I needed to build that for my own self-preservation.
Yeah, so, it was a hack.
Yeah, so in those first few ceremonies, I mean, it was scary because I thought, well, what do I call myself after this? What are people in my recovery community going to think and so on? But what became abundantly clear to me was that, and I've done, of course, a lot of research and just examination of this because I've benefited so much from many different experiences over the past few years, is that higher states of consciousness can heal, right? And there were parts within myself that didn't heal. And I found ways through meditation and neurofeedback and different things that had elevated my consciousness, but not to the point of sitting with ayahuasca or 5-MeO-DMT or some of the things that I've experienced. And what's interesting is the origin of the 12 steps, and many people don't know this. And let me give the caveat. This is just my story. I'm not telling someone who's trying to be sober that they should do psychedelics. I really want to make that clear.
Yeah, we can talk more about the most efficacious ones for that, but keep going with your story.
I mean, it's important to say that because this is not me promoting this. This is saying I am shocked that this has been my experience, and it's fascinating and beautiful, and it's benefited me a lot. I don't know that that would be true for everyone.
It can be dangerous, especially if you do it to be cool. If you don't have the intuitive calling and you don't check in with someone who's not you, I think doing ayahuasca is exceptionally dangerous.
Well, I contemplated this for about 2 years.
See, you did it right.
Weekend we're going to go sit with ayahuasca. Want to go? And I'm like, yeah, what the hell? So I'll just, you know, give that caveat and just really, this is earnestly from my heart. These medicines are not something to play around with. It can get very dark and things could go horribly wrong. And I know that because when I was an addict, I did LSD and mushrooms all the time and had terrifying, horrific experiences. And because I wasn't doing so consciously, there was no intention other than to try to numb the experience of being me. But anyway, the really interesting piece here is that if you look at the origins of the 12 steps, and that began with the organization Alcoholics Anonymous, the co-founder, Bill Wilson, story is very fascinating. He was a drunkard stockbroker from New York City, and you know he tried to dry up again and again. It never worked. Well, he checked himself into this hospital called Towns Hospital and went through a drying out process in which they administered something called belladonna, which was sort of a cocktail of the plant medicine belladonna and some other sedatives to get him through the DTs. Because coming off alcohol addiction can be extremely dangerous, and you can die from alcohol withdrawals
It's a deadly nightshade.
Much more so than a lot of other drugs. I mean, coming off heroin's not fun, but you're not going to die, likely. So he takes this plant medicine mixture, has all these wild hallucinations, and then a couple days later has the infamous white light experience upon which the entire program and the entire 12 steps is built. And that was...
based on a plant journey? Wow.
Yeah. And it's a really interesting dichotomy. I just find this so fascinating. So he had this peak experience, then a couple days later, probably still in the DTs a bit, and the after effects of that integration. And the way he described it in the book called Alcoholics Anonymous is that the whole room filled with white light and he felt the presence of God and the presence of love. And from that moment on, the guy never had a drink ever again. So it was not the plant medicine, but it was the spiritual experience, the transcendent experience that was a higher state of consciousness that allowed him to access God, source, whatever you want to call it, to give him the restraint and remove that obsession. So then he goes on to get these downloads, which are codified within the actual writings of the 12 steps, which are essentially universal principles that are present in many different lineage and of spirituality and religions and so on, right? Just be a moral person, essentially. Have integrity.
Right.
They're about building
pesky things.
They're really just based on having integrity. So the purpose of him creating the 12 steps was to elicit a similar spiritual experience so that one could have a spiritual awakening and no longer have the need to use alcohol or drugs addictively, right? So it's really interesting that... And then he later went on to experiment with LSD with Aldous Huxley in the 60s, which is crazy. And he wanted to bring LSD into AA And of course, you know, wisely so, I think everyone said, Bill, you're nuts. We're not bringing, you know, it was legal then. It was like a psychiatric medicine.
Yeah, Stan Grof has been on the show, the guy who first used it in medical practice, right?
Right. So there's a history that's inconvenient for many in terms of recovery. And rightly so, and I respect that because complete abstinence was the path for me. But what I can say, after some years of venturing into the realm of psychedelics with some degree of consistency, is that there were traumas in my body and in my psyche that were preventing me from living my life fully as a sober man, despite 22 years of very committed spiritual work, years of Kundalini yoga, years of every 12-step group you can think of for every problem you might have, A Course in Miracles, reading Eckhart Tolle, reading Ram Dass, David Hawkins, going to India, meditating.
All of the above.
and my life improved dramatically, but there were still things within me in terms of true acceptance and self-love and just healing abuse and trauma that I experienced as a kid that I just couldn't get to it until I explored that realm. And nothing has come close to being able to provide those benefits to me. And also,
when you say nothing, do you mean you've taken? I have, let's see, 5-MeO-DMT, psilocybin, ayahuasca, peyote, and ketamine.
That sounds like a lot when you say it like that.
Well, I mean, which of them are we referring to here?
You know, each one has had its own benefit. And I said, when you read that list, it sounds like you're a drug addict, dude. You're doing all these drugs, right? but that's over the course of 4 years, right? And it's like each time that, I mean, I live in Austin. I could be doing plant medicines every weekend.
I find I do them more often now that I'm in Austin. It's kind of weird how that is.
So it's not something I seek out. I'm not looking for it. These experiences that you just listed have literally just fallen on my doorstep. Hey, Luke, I have this intuitive hit that you're supposed to be here at this retreat in a month. I take a few days, think about it, and 90% of the time, it's a no, because I don't have a good reason to be there. Mm-hmm. There's nothing I want to work on or manifest or heal, or just the set and setting doesn't resonate with me. But out of those experiences, each different medicine has had such diverse benefits in terms of healing and realization, and also just a deepening of my relationship with God, which is the very most important thing in my life and the thing that got me sober in the first place. How I got sober, Dave, is I checked myself into rehab. I had never been around religion. I wasn't spiritual. I didn't believe in God. I guess I would be an agnostic at that time. Just like, I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but all I know of it is like from movies of people going to church. Like, I'm so disconnected from any contact with that realm.
One of the best things you can do to improve how you feel is to get at least 6.5 hours of quality sleep every night. Why? Because your body heals itself when you sleep, which reduces your risk of just about every disease and makes it easier to lose weight on top of that. So how do you get more quality sleep every night? Well, you could make sure you're getting enough magnesium. Believe it or not, about 75% of us don't have enough of it. Even worse, most magnesium supplements don't fix your deficiency or help you sleep better. That's why I recommend Magnesium Breakthrough. It's a full-spectrum supplement with 7 different forms of magnesium. You just take 2 capsules before you go to bed and look at how much better you feel the next morning and how much better you sleep. Because you're a regular subscriber on the podcast, the team at Bioptimizers is giving you a discount. All you've got to do is go to magbreakthrough.com/Dave, use code Dave10, and you can save up to 47%. That's magbreakthrough.com/Dave, use code Dave10.
You're listening to The Human Upgrade with Dave Asprey.
Movies of people going to church. Like, I'm so disconnected from any contact with that realm.
What, was that an Eddie Murphy movie?
But I check into rehab and I'm going through all kinds of crazy withdrawal and I'm like, can you guys give me some Dilaudid or something? You know, I go to the nurse and she said, oh no, you don't need that. You know, we checked your vitals. You're fine. You just got to rough it. And I said, well, give me something. She said, Luke, you have to go to your room and pray. Pray to God to remove your obsession. And that's all she gave me. So that's all I did. And I went to my little room in that rehab And I literally, like, I just from seeing it in the movies, it's the only way I knew how to do it. I got on my hands and knees. I put my hands in prayer position. And I prayed the most humble, sincere prayer of my life that was just, I want to be free. I just want to be free. I'm not asking for anything, but just take this freaking obsession out of my body and my mind. And from that moment until this moment right now, I've never experienced that ever again.
Wow.
But that was, there was work to follow up on that, or I would have relapsed for sure. But I surrounded myself. I changed my whole life. But with each of those medicine experiences, I've worked through something different, right? Because they each have their own flavor, and each shaman or facilitator has their own unique energy, the sort of energetic grid, the container, the context of the experience.
That's why the shaman really matters with these medicines, right?
So much, yeah. And I've thankfully, I've never had a negative experience.
Don't do it with a newbie.
Yeah, because I've been very discerning. I have a wife who's very experienced in these realms and is even more discerning than I am, you know, and I trust her vision on things. But with something like 5-MeO, I mean, unequivocally, those experiences have by far been the most profound experiences of my life. Wow. I mean, outside of so far, so much so, it's ineffable, so, right? There's no words to describe the place that you access for that brief period of time. And even just having those experiences sans any realizations or inner work or understanding, just being in a state of non-duality for 3 to 5 minutes fundamentally changed who I am forever, and there's no going back. And in terms of the things you talk about, reactivity and being triggered and your nervous system not being able to be regulated and all the things that are also useful in the biohacking realm, neurofeedback and all of that, I mean, the things that I'm able to be resilient through when my nervous system gets triggered and there's a natural moment of fight or flight, like I'm shocked at how quickly I come back into my body and I'm me again. And I couldn't do that before. Neurofeedback, all these things help. Float tanks, I mean, I made a lot of progress. But some of those experiences that you mentioned have just fundamentally changed me into a totally different person.
Wow.
Right? But some of it, I think, is also because of the fact that I did have 22 years of a model that I had created. Like, I know what the goal is, right? I want a deep level of presence. I want a spiritual connection. I want loving, healthy relationships. I want it to be an integrous, honest, authentic, loving, kind, patient, forgiving person. Right? I've been working on all of that and making progress. So going into those experiences, I'm not just kind of like, let's see what happens. Like, I know what I want to work on, and I know what's blocking me. So in that first ayahuasca ceremony, I mean, I had no idea that it was going to be that powerful. I'm sitting there 22 years sober, sitting on my mat with my eyes closed, just waiting for it to happen. And it starts to happen. And I've never felt so free in my whole life, you know? And the freedom really came from learning to trust myself and that this isn't an excuse to get high or escapism.
It's hard to get addicted to ayahuasca. You throw up. Like it's rough.
Unless you like throwing up licorice, you know, juice, essentially. Yeah. But anyway, you know, it's to your question, each of those experiences have been so unique and so beautiful and at times harrowing and, you know, facing things that are very difficult to look at within myself, things that I'm ashamed of or still hurt by or areas in which I'm still stuck. There's still something in the subconscious and I need to go into that quantum realm in order to get in there and kind of do a psychic surgery and remove those parts of myself and evolve and emerge as a different person. You know, I mean, I used to be terrified of having kids. It was like my absolute worst nightmare. I would never commit in relationships.
Yeah, I had that too.
And now we're in the process of wanting to get pregnant and going through whatever is necessary to do so.
It's a lot of work.
Now, for example, just one small example, I'm more afraid now of not having a kid.
Well, you've done so much inner child healing work.
Well, that's
profound. That's what it takes.
That's it. So, you know, in summary, again, you know, I don't recommend this journey for others, but I would be doing myself and others a disservice to not be open and honest about this what it for me is a unique experience. I'm sure there are many other people that are combining both of these realms, right, of a addiction recovery and also using different medicines to heal. But to me, it's still just front page news in my awareness because the change that I've experienced has been so profound.
Wow. I think you did a lot of the personal work before you did the plant medicine. I see a disturbing trend in people saying, I'm going to go to ayahuasca, which is one of the more dangerous substances, actually. I'm going to do that first. And I have some friends who are like, oh, I've done 200 ceremonies. I'm like, when is it not working?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
you know, at what point? And so I do see kind of a disturbing trend. And because it is uniquely, I think, dangerous spiritually, it needs to be treated with reverence and respect. And
I
prefer to do it with someone who's exceptionally experienced at sitting with it because a good shaman's like a firewall.
Oh, 100%.
To keep the bad stuff out while you get rid of your
100%.
Bad stuff.
100%. That's I'm so glad you brought that up because I'm always conscious to give, you know, my disclaimers.
Yeah.
But this one that you bring here is really important because when the veils of your, as you would call your meat OS, right? When your awareness, your consciousness is no longer confined within your senses and you're in a realm where your senses are pushed to the side and you truly are in a quantum realm of no space and no time, not only do benevolent angels and guides and God itself reside there, but because we're living in a polarity, we're living in a duality in that realm, there is also polarity and there are definitely dark forces in that realm. And this is very traumatizing for many people that go into it sort of willy-nilly and don't have the protection of a proper guide.
Those things will move right in and take up residence if you don't have
the
right guide.
Yeah, yeah. And this is, I mean, in circles I run in, I mean, I won't say it's common with people that I'm friends with and stuff because I think they have the same level of discernment and caution around this or maybe prudence. But, I mean, I do hear stories, and I know they're true, of people taking on entities or just, you know, almost becoming possessed and just having really dark experiences. You know, whether or not those goblins exist in those realms or not, they emerge worse, right? And have a very difficult time finding their way back to this reality. So yeah, it's definitely nothing to play with. But for me, you know, when I've done so with that prudence and being very mindful about it, I've had nothing but positive experiences.
And you did your work first. You did lots of personal development work, lots of therapy, addiction recovery, neurofeedback, breath work, cold therapy. Like you did the preparatory work instead of just jumping in looking for a panacea.
Well, that, you know, that explains why you hear these stories, right? Of because I've benefited so much, I've been a bit naive in terms of if I meet someone and they say, oh, I've sat with ayahuasca a few times, I would immediately trust that person because I think they've done the same work that I have, right?
No.
But it's so interesting.
It's actually a sign they're weird.
You see people that have had a lot of these experiences yet still really lack moral fortitude and just integrity, right?
Which is you can lack integrity and do ayahuasca 100 times. You won't get integrity. That comes from something else.
Right. It's like you hear these stories of these you know, predatory shaman in South America and stuff, and they're drinking ayahuasca all the time and they're raping people, you know? So it doesn't necessarily, if you have a peak experience, it doesn't necessarily give you access to or instill you with moral character and trustworthiness, right? It's interesting to me, and it's one of my kind of points of naivete that I'm learning to overcome, that just because I've had such tremendous transformation and I've become a much more pure person, just wholly speaking.
Even since I first worked with you on coaching, you've dramatically evolved. It's really impressive.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to toot my own horn.
No, I practice integrity in my word. I don't say things that aren't true at any level that I'm aware of.
Well, I appreciate that, and you know, all by the grace of God, honestly. But it's like the way I look at the relationship with God for me, and I, you know, it's not a religious thing, but it truly is a relationship, and it's like a partnership. And so when I show up fully and I'm really ready to change and I'm ready to surrender those parts of myself that are based in falsehood, the power that's needed to cause that change is the power of God. And it's like when I give my humble permission and I really surrender and turn myself over, then these tremendous changes take place because I've allowed them to happen. And all I've really done is shown up and said, hey, there's some things about me that I would really like to change because they're not working for me. God, could you help me? Mm. Which is what I did in that first prayer. I wasn't asking to be a millionaire or have a lot of pretty women around or a fancy car. I just said, God, I want to be free. And I'm willing to do whatever it takes to facilitate that liberation. Which for me, the message from God through the people around me was, you need to go to goddamn meetings every day. Mm. You need to give up your old friends. You got to have a whole new life. And I was willing to do so. You have to learn to meditate. You got to pray, read spiritual books. I did my work, but the real transformational energy and power came from and continues to come from God. It's like I'm giving God keys to my room and he's coming in and cleaning it up, you know?
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm a participant in the process. So okay. When you say, yeah, you've grown a lot, it's like, well, yeah, and I've been partly responsible, but mostly it's just grace. It's just me allowing grace to infiltrate my life and my awareness and to change things about myself that I have difficulty changing in and of myself and my own willpower.
It seems like a lot of the substances that you were using actually, they work on some level to help facilitate forgiveness, which is at the core of the work, the healing work that I do. And you know, you've been through a very early version of 40 years of Zen. And that protocol has evolved since you did it. And it's actually in my new book, In Smarter Not Harder. Just how to do a reset, to do a rapid forgiveness with or without technology. But when I did ketamine for the show, I was like, oh, wow, this is a complete forgiveness drug. Like when I sit on this, now that I know how to do the reset, I can just go bam, bam, bam. I'm like, oh, man, I hadn't thought about that girl in high school. Okay, it looks like there's something to forgive there. And you just like get it done. So some of these really facilitate that. And sometimes, you know, there's downloads and all. The one that you haven't done, though, is the one that I would actually recommend to a friend who would call and say, I have an addiction problem. And that's Ibogaine, because Ibogaine resets your neurotransmitter receptivity kind of back to baseline. It's like a reset. So people describe doing it, and then the next day, they don't crave alcohol, they don't crave heroin, they don't crave nicotine even, they don't crave anything, right? And it's not one that you microdose. It's when you do it, it's intense.
Yeah.
A buddy of mine who's a high-level military guy from one of the branches went through an Ibogaine ceremony recently for traumatic brain injury. And I had a chance to talk with Jared from Black Rifle, because now I'm in Austin. I get to hang out with cool people. You know, and he's also working on, you know, on companies like Mission Within, which is taking veterans with brain injuries and using the same thing. It's very interesting that they're having profound resolution of trauma and brain injury, as well as addiction recovery from this one of the plant substances. But I don't think you see that from, say, doing ayahuasca. But I do think you see trauma resolution more from ketamine than you would Aya. But, you know, Aya is like a slippery kind of a snake.
Yeah.
If you see snakes.
It is interesting that, like, on paper, the most logical substance for me to work with would be Iboga or Ibogaine, right? The reason why I've never done it, and it's around, is honestly, I've never felt called.
There you go. And I'm so happy you
said that. So you could say that, and if I wasn't thinking correctly, I'd be like, oh, well, Dave, yeah, that makes sense, so I'll go do that. But it has to do more than make sense. It has to make my heart flutter a bit. There has to be, ooh, a tingly yes. So there's a charm, a sense of charm that draws me into the experience.
Yes.
That brings that decision. If it's just an intellectual curiosity, it's a no.
Good.
And for me, it's not only got to be a yes, it has to be a yes on multiple days in a row where I recheck in and I go, I'm signed up for this thing. I could still pull out. Is this a yes, Luke? It's still a yes. Like, for example, there's an opportunity in a month or two to sit with Bufo again, 5-MeO-DMT. And I've done that quite a few times, and I mean, some of them have been a little scary because of the ego dissolution, the part of me that doesn't want to let go of being me and having a persona and an intellect, right? I mean, it's such an immersive experience. So I haven't felt called to do that at all. And
I don't feel any call there.
After the last few times, which happened incidentally in one day, I thought, I'm probably done for life. But someone texted me and said, hey, I'm coming to town. I'm going to be serving that medicine. If you know anyone, you know, doors open. I was like, oh, that's nice. I'll keep it in mind if I know someone who's curious about that and wants to lean in. And ever since I got that text, there's been a little tingly feeling in my awareness. It's like, that's a maybe for me.
So,
but it, okay. It's got to go from a maybe to a yes, to a hell yes, to an F yes before I'm going to walk in that door. And I might even walk in the door, you know, hypothetically speaking, sit on the mat. And if I get a maybe then, I'm walking out.
I actually have done that, actually specifically with ayahuasca. I've done it twice in 23 years. And there would have been a time in the middle, but when I was there, I'm like, I am absolutely not called to this. And I was getting a hell no from my nervous system, so I said no. I don't think the spirit of ayahuasca liked that very much, but it was. I had some interesting things happen after that, but that's how you have to roll. And you said something that's really precious for people listening to the show. You've also been an addict. Tell me the difference between that tingly feeling, and that's you in my world. That's you tuning into your operating system, your innate knowing, and being able to hear that signal out of all the noise. But you also have a signal in your operating system that is the addiction signal.
Yeah.
And if I was to sit here, and I don't want to be mean, and if this is too much, tell me to go fuck myself. Yeah. But if I was here with some heroin, how would the tingle you would get from that differ from a hell yes? Like, this is a major teaching moment for people listening.
Yeah.
How do you know intuition versus urge?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's interesting because I've just had this freedom from those substances that were so problematic. It's where I don't even have an aversion to it.
Oh, so you're really free of it. No aversion, no attraction.
No, it's a neutrality. So it's like, you know, a lot of people use cannabis recreationally, and that was my number one drug. I mean, just the smell of that would just send me into a frenzy when I was a kid, you know? And people will be smoking weed, you know, just when I'm out and about, for example, and I'll take a whiff and I go, that smells really nice. And there's just no part of me that says that smells nice, therefore I need to put it in my lungs. And it's the difference between like alignment and infatuation, right? When there's a medicine opportunity that I'm feeling into that feels like it could be a yes, I'm waiting for sort of the will of nature and my will to line up. And there's sort of a lock and key that go click. And it's a different feeling than the addiction, which is an infatuation, an obsession.
Okay.
It's a thinking about when you're going to get it, who has it, how you're going to get more, where you're going to get the money. You're anticipating the relief that's going to come once you get it.
And that's lacking from, say, a desire to
the anticipation I have around psychedelics is like, oh shit, my ego is not going to like this.
Okay.
It's an anticipation of, oh man, we're going to be treading in some deep water here. Are you ready for this? It's more of, it's an alignment. And if the alignment is out of alignment, then it's a no. With addiction, there's no capacity to even think of saying no, because it's based in a visceral desire and a cravingness. There's a craving, there's a wanting and a longing to it. There isn't an inspiration, right? When my friend texts me about the 5-MeO, it's like, ooh, that's an interesting idea. It's not a, oh God, I gotta have that idea.
Got it, that's the difference.
It's pretty neutral. If anything, it's like, oh, just a little subtle sense of charm. But when something addictive was placed in my, in front of me when I was addicted, there was literally no option to say no. It was actually impossible to not do it because my willpower would be overcome by the need to anesthetize myself. And I think now I also don't have the need to be anesthetized. Sometimes
right.
I wonder, like, we're going to go grab a bite if we still have time. But we could sit down and it's possible that I could have a half a glass of red wine and go live my life and never be an alcoholic again.
I actually think it's likely, but you shouldn't try.
Yeah, but the consequences, yeah, if I'm wrong,
they're
are
big.
Dire.
Right.
And literally speaking, possibly deadly, you know?
You know what we could do if you wanted to try it?
What?
I'll have a A stun gun. And you drink the wine and I'll zap you a few times on the balls. And your body will be like, never again, never again. So we'll associate a relapse with electrical shock. What do you think?
Maybe we try it? It works for some. I mean, they used to use electroshock therapy on alcoholics back in the day. But you know,
for a different way, not for aversion. I'm thinking of the Pavlov, where for nicotine addiction, it works well. But it turns out the body hates electrical shock. So if you give it a little thing it likes, followed by a shock, you'd be like, never mind.
Yeah.
But let's not try it. I don't think you should ever have any alcohol again.
And the difference there, Dave, is there's nothing that I need to numb from in my experience of myself, right? So I'm not overtaken by the curiosity to see if I could have a glass of wine
because
I don't need a glass of wine. Yeah. I feel fine. I mean, maybe I have, I don't know, some kava or something just if I want to relax. I mean, there's things I can use that don't have any consequences that aren't addictive that relax me. Take CBD or something like that, right? But yeah, it's a really good question that you pose. You know, how do you know the difference between like, you know, a curious intrigue or, you know, an intuitive thought or a craving and a need and a want. And they're so easy to tell apart because of how your nervous system feels in assessing that decision.
Yeah. It's because you learned through your practice to tune into your nervous system to know how it feels. Something else that I found is helpful for those things. If there's something that you're considering, and without mentioning it, it just comes up three times in a short period of time, like over the course of a couple of days, just random people mentioning it. Maybe the universe is just random, but I don't think so. Yeah. It doesn't appear to be.
It wasn't for me.
No, and so that's a good thing. Like, pay attention. I don't care if it's a book you should read, an episode of a show you listen to. If three people tell you to do it, they're getting a message from somewhere, especially if they don't know each other. Like something's going on there. So you just take note. Right, and then you tune in, and what I find is both with 40 years of Zen or plant ceremonies, if you feel a little bit of fear, that's a good thing, right? Because that's your animal operating system, your meat OS saying, don't you dare hack into me and be in charge. You will be afraid if you hack into me. I'm in charge, not you. And another name for that, at least portions or parts of your operating system, are your ego. The ego's in there to drive the operating system. And the ego doesn't like it that you're in there too. It's like, God damn it. Like, why does this guy keep messing with my
operating
system?
And it doesn't like to let go of its role.
No. So people feel that the day before they go to a transformative experience, whether it's Aya, whether it's 40 years of Zen, whether it's, a deep holotropic breath work, there's like anticipation, a little bit of, and then sometimes in the middle of it, as you know, from doing 40 years, there's usually a time when you like hit this wall and you're just really angry. And that's when you're about to pop a bubble in your ego, when you're really going to hack into your nervous system and your operating system. And that's where all the forgiveness and the letting go and all that works. My experience has been that if you do holotropic breathing, you do EMDR, you do internal family systems therapy, like Gabby Bernstein talks about, I think in Mast and Kip probably, on the show. If you do those things first, and then you say, well, maybe you should learn tantric sex or heck, BDSM. It doesn't matter. Do those things, which all are reliable paths to altered states. Do holotropic breathing or something else. Learn some yoga. And if that still doesn't work, then you could start light with ketamine, which is legal and easily available. Then do ketamine, right? Then maybe mushrooms, right? And then maybe 5-MeO. And then maybe ayahuasca.
Sage advice.
Is that a good order of operations? What would you edit in there?
God, I don't. I think it's so individual. You know, I mean, I've met people for whom their first experience was 5-MeO, which is by far more intense, and
it can be a destabilizing
and life changing. Yeah. And I've met people that did that as their first thing, and then way down the road ended up doing some ketamine therapy. So I don't know, but I think you have a point there.
I mean, for a virgin who has no clue.
The safety and legality, I think what you said about the holotropic breath work, I mean, you can achieve some deep states of healing. Yeah, and I did it essentially in Kundalini yoga. And I would see visuals and have all kinds of...
I saw past lives on that stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, like spontaneous tears and trauma healing or just ecstatic laughter. I mean, you can do a lot within your own system. But I think your sequence there is pretty good. I had another friend who was also sober, and he was having some anxiety and depression or just blocks he still couldn't overcome after many years. And he went and did clinical ketamine therapy and healed his anxiety and depression. And then later on, went and very deliberately and intentionally started exploring some of the other medicines mm-hmm. that were not legal in the United States and potentially more intense and whatnot. So I think that's a good starting point. And even microdosing, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. there's a lot of benefit in my experience to be had, even in just sub-perceptual doses of different substances.
But not Ibogaine. Microdosing Ibogaine is a bad idea.
I've never heard of that. No. Doesn't sound like a good
idea. Tim Ferriss talked about doing that when I interviewed him last on the show. And since then, I just learned more about the neurobiology of that. I'm like, I don't think that's a microdose kind of thing.
Yeah.
But kudos to him for trying.
Right? Yeah, that wouldn't be my first go-to. I enjoy microdosing LSD and psilocybin and also sometimes Kana, which is a really beautiful, it's actually legal. It's a South African shrub, a really ancient plant medicine. And it, in large doses, is similar to MDMA. But in microdose, it's a really good mood elevator and heart opener, sort of like if you ate a crap load of chocolate, you know, that kind of theobromine sort of feeling.
I haven't tried Kano. I'll have to give it a shot.
Yeah, it's really nice and it's legal. So, there are ways for people to kind of dip their toe in the water safely if they feel called. And many people don't and never will, and they're going to have a great life too.
I also want to point out, so I'm on Daniel Amen's board of directors, and his neuroimaging work absolutely saved my career. And, you know, just it was actually part of the birth of biohacking, in that I'm going to business school and I'm failing and I don't know why. And I feel like it's maybe I'm just stupid. And I did one of his early spec scans and it's like, oh, look, you have a broken brain. You have a harder problem.
Yeah.
So he's been very consistent with his work, and I believe it wholeheartedly. Otherwise, I wouldn't be on his board. And he talks about and shows you pictures of what alcohol and cannabis do to your brain. They are bad for you. That's not to say that there isn't a case for taking oral cannabis in certain circumstances where it may be beneficial, but for the average person, it's not helping, even if it feels like it is. But it is recreationally fun. If you do it on occasion, you're probably fine. But alcohol, it turns out, isn't that good. But when it comes to things like regular use of ketamine and other things like that, he'll show you picture after picture of people's brains where the metabolism is harmed by doing this. And even ayahuasca, he's like, Dave, you know, even a single dose, like, it is not good for the brain. It takes a long time for the brain to recover. And the lesson beyond all this is, A, you probably should be following Daniel Amen's work. Doc Amen, I think, is his handle on most things. If you're considering any of this kind of work, because you need to understand what it may do to your brain. And it's also the reminder that says this is an occasional practice at best with a long recovery and integration period. This is not a regular, yeah. I'm going to do it every 2 weeks because I live in Austin practice.
Yeah,
I think that's harmful.
Yeah, no, good advice. Yeah, he did a brain scan for me and it was alarming to say the least. So much so that I immediately went out and bought a hyperbaric chamber and probably did 200 sessions in that thing.
Did it help?
Oh, very much so. Very much so, yeah. Yeah. I haven't done a follow-up scan, but you know, what I found interesting with the hyperbaric that I actually really enjoyed was, because I would just meditate in there, essentially. I mean, there's not much else to do depending on the style that you have. Mine was the lay down kind, so yeah. You're going to lay down. Yeah. So I kind of meditate, take a nap, but I would go in there and microdose ketamine, like a ketamine troche.
Yep.
Yeah, and listen to like a Joe Dispenza meditation or mm-hmm. New Calm or something like that. And I had some really just deeply restorative, beautiful experiences doing that. There's something about the sensory deprivation element of a chamber.
Yeah.
You're in there, no one can get in, you can't get out, at least not quickly. And also just the blood flow to the brain of whatever you happen to be taking. Now, Amen would probably really hate that.
He would support the ketamine.
Yeah, because I remember asking him, I think, about ayahuasca or psilocybin or something. He was like, never do it. It destroys your brain. I said, okay, noted. I'll be mindful.
I actually trust him quite a lot there. And there is a case for microdosing psilocybin because it increases BDNF and it increases neuroplasticity. And I've never asked him about microdosing. Next time I talk to him, I will.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see what he has to say. You know, and I respect his point of view, but then, you know, there's also the
he's a master.
Yeah. There's also subjective experience, right? Where you read a list of all these things I've done in the last 4 years and my brain's never worked better. Now, I don't know what it would look like under a scan.
You also did hyperbaric, which may be mitigating. And I mean, I've had an OxyHealth hyperbaric chamber for 15 years at my house, including a hard chamber as well as a soft chamber for much of that time. And I just think there's a case for it, but they're expensive. And I'm actually working with them on a way of making this much more affordable for people.
Oh, good. I just actually sold mine because, begrudgingly, because I'm experiencing a bout of tinnitus that's gotten really bad. And I noticed that when I would do chamber sessions, it would get worse. And so I reached out to Dr. Scott Scher, who's a big HBOT guy, and I was like, does this hurt your ears? And he said, no, it's fine for your ears, except if you have the specific type of inner ear damage to those nerve cells, it can make it worse. And I thought, I must have that, because I would track it and just see, yeah, maybe it's just a one-off, and it would happen again. And eventually I just had to go, you know, I can't do anything that's going to irritate my ears, sadly, because I love
that chamber. Did you say irritate your ears?
Irritate my ears.
I saw you did there.
Yeah, irritate. It's a new term, irritate.
We could go down a whole path of biohacking that, but it is time for us to wind up the show and go grab some grass-fed something. Thanks for coming on the show. Your website, Luke Story, Storey. You've got a show. Let's see, what else are you doing? You've got an EMF home safety masterclass,
yeah,
which is actually really cool. And guys, you want to check that out, because EMFs have been a part of biohacking since the first conference where I talked about grounding and earthing as being a part of it. And if you go to Upgrade Labs today, you'll see that there's an earthing area there where we have it wired in, because it's actually important. So again, lukestory.com, and you've got stuff on EMF and a bunch of other cool stuff you're working on.
Yeah.
You're a cool dude.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate you having me on, and I'm glad you moved to Austin. We need more good people here. It seems like everyone I know in the world that's really making a difference has moved here, and I just feel so lucky. There's just so much going on at this particular place on earth at the moment, and you're a great addition. So welcome.
I was happy to find you'd moved here. I moved from it. Yeah. Look at all these people I know who used to be in LA and everywhere else. Like, everyone cool is, not everyone, but many cool people here. So I found there were more people I knew here than I even imagined. So
yeah.
I'm glad we got to hang out. And I'm sad you're like this far outside of town.
Yeah, I live in the boonies.
But it's kind of fun.
And it's nice. It's quiet and it's lower EMF. Huh?
Well, I just live next to a military base. Yeah.
Really?
Well, kind of.
Oh, wow.
My EMFs aren't that high in my house, though.
Yeah. Military bases make me nervous because of all the radar.
Yeah, this is a National Guard. I don't think they have so much radar.
Oh, okay, good. So, good. That's good.
If it was like a full-on Air Force base, no. Just
yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I actually think that the toxic mold is worse near Air Force bases, because we know that EMFs irritate mold to make more toxins.
Yeah.
I think that's why San Diego is kind of like a mold bomb.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah,
yeah, I heard that a while back. It makes a lot of sense, right? Because the mold is fighting for its survival and it's sensing that threat. So it's like trying to make more mold.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Luke. I'm sure I'll see you at some event in Austin. If not, come back on the show or vice versa. Guys, again, this was Luke Story. You've heard him before. But he's a longtime biohacker with a metaphysical bent, and his show is awesome as well.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
You're listening to The Human Upgrade with Dave Asprey.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.